Cut out.
This is Lacrosse Talk with your hosts, Dan Matthews and Max Frater.
Good morning, lacrosse fans, and this is Lacrosse Talk, January 18th, 2015. We are in the middle of our preview shows, and we've got another great preview show lined up for you today. But without any further ado, we have major announcements, Max. Lots of changes taking place, not only with Lacrosse Talk, but with the way people are going to be getting their Lacrosse Talk radio experiences.
And it's about time. I mean, there's about five or six shows out there, and it's all of us. I mean, a lot of what we do is to try and give you guys the best opportunity to know what's going on in the world of lacrosse everywhere around the country, but you have to go to five, six different spots every week, every weekend, just to get all this information. So we're going to combine it into one for you.
Yeah, and well, we've been the melting pot, and Lacrosse Talk was the first show to come on the air. I think that through our experiences, the last 5 years anyway, we've learned that we are going to be better together than we are as any individual show.
I mean, that's everybody, no matter whether you're doing a radio show or you're working for ESPN or you're a beat writer for a lacrosse blog. At the end of the day, the goal is to grow the game. And so all of us who are working hard at making sure that we provide all this content for you guys out there who love the game and play the game, I mean, it's important for us to work together in order to fully, I don't know the best way to say this, but just to make sure that lacrosse is growing at the same rate every single year and that we're on our end working hard to do it. And this change is going to be for the better. There's no doubt.
So Laxworm contacted a whole bunch of us just about 2.5-3 weeks ago, and he says, "Guys, we could be stronger together than we are as individual shows, and as such, I would like to create a station on TuneIn where we can put all of our stuff." And so a bunch of us got together, including Dan Parr from Destiny Lacrosse, us, the Maryland Sports Insider, Lax Worm, JoJo Wardrummer, and a handful of others, and we are forming the Laxworm Radio Experience on TuneIn. It will launch next weekend at the U.S. Lacrosse Convention in Baltimore, Maryland, and it's just something we're really excited about. And on our end, Max, we will be running Lacrosse Talk beginning on February 8th. Actually, it'll start next week, but Lacrosse Talk will not only be here on Blog Talk Radio, but it'll also move over to the Laxworm Radio Experience on TuneIn, where it will air at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. And that will be our permanent slot. We will be recording the next two or three shows, but beyond that, we will be rolling live at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Laxworm Radio Experience on TuneIn. And additionally, I have spent the last week roughly putting together a schedule in the Rocky Mountain region, as well as up in Minnesota and a weekend down in Arizona, of live play-by-play coverage, really spanning the entire globe as far as levels of lacrosse. We're going to do high school lacrosse here locally. We'll also do MCLA Division I and II lacrosse and NCAA Division I, Division II, and Division III lacrosse on the Laxworm Radio Experience. And I can't tell you how exciting this whole process really has been so far, and how much I think we're both looking forward to it.
It's still very, very brand new too, so everybody keep that in mind. We obviously have grand plans, and we're going to try and enforce them as accurately as possible, but I mean, this is still all new. I mean, 3-4 weeks ago, Dan and I didn't have any plans of joining a 24/7 lacrosse radio show experience. And then, like you said, Laxworm calls us up, gets everybody on a conference call and says, you know what, I believe that this can work. If we're all willing to provide content under one roof rather than have everybody go to different outlets to try and find things, it's gonna grow the game a lot quicker, and it's going to be way more efficient for us radio guys. So big plans ahead. I'm excited. It's kind of unknown territory for us, but you know what? It's something that needs to be done for the sport, and I think we're taking a huge step in the right direction.
Should be a whole lot of fun, and our format won't change. We're still going to be the melting pot. We're going to get that melting pot started right now. We spoke to Tim Haslam, our MCLA insider, on Thursday evening, and talked a little bit of MCLA Division I lacrosse. Bring in our MCLA insider, Tim Haslam, with our Division I preview this week. And Tim, how are you today?
Oh, I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. Tim, as always, we appreciate the time and look forward to your insights. Division II or Division I is a completely different beast from Division II. A lot of power within these Division I programs, including a couple of newer teams who are making some serious noise very early and very often in Division I, in the likes of Westminster, Grand Canyon, and even Davenport.
You know, it's true. And it's good to see, you know, a couple of different situations with each one. You know, Davenport and Westminster are pretty similar, and they've moved up from the Division II ranks. And then you have Grand Canyon, who's moved down from the NCAA ranks. And it's just good to see. You know, I call all the Westminster games on their webcast, so I get to see them firsthand. And they've come a long way, that's for sure.
Tim, thanks for joining us on the show today. Let's take a look back at the national championship last year between the Buffs and the Sun Devils. ASU running the table all the way to what looked like might be their first national championship as one of the more prominent MCLA organizations over the past years. But they ran into an incredibly hot CU team. Both teams lost a lot from the championship game, but you could say ASU probably lost the most and picked up a new head coach in Joseph Thone. So talk a little bit about what this new ASU team is going to look like, and are they going to be at the same level that they were that made it to the championship game?
I think they will be at the same level. You know, they still have a bunch of good players coming back. You know, the question is, will Coach Thone be able to implement, you know, his systems, or will he, you know, just kind of use what's been in place? And so that's the big question, you know. I had a chance to talk to him in the fall, and he is just a great guy and really, you know, anxious to get work in. You know, obviously they have been, but just get out there and get things done, you know. And I think he's got the talent to do that. You know, they're returning Dan Davis, who was an MCLA first team All-American last year. Their face-off guys, I believe, is back. And so they've got a lot going for them still in terms of talent on the field. You know, the question mark, though, is will Coach Thone be able to pull it together and get it done?
And on the other side of things, you've got the Buffs, who were the national champs, still have their head coach in John Galvin, but lose a ton of talent on the offensive side. Jack Cranston, Tyler Doherty, and most importantly, Riley Seidel, all gone from that roster. How do the Buffs respond, and who's going to step up to fill those shoes in order for them to maintain this level?
You know, it's kind of an RMLC thing where they just kind of reload, you know. You know, Colorado State had a down year in air quotes last year and still did very, very well. You know, so it'll be interesting to see who steps up, you know, along your side. They've got John Clayton coming back. There's actually a couple of kids from Utah, my neck of the woods, that could see some time. Which I'm excited to see, you know. And then they had a bunch of juniors that saw a bunch of time last year. You know, you've got, oh geez, just a bunch. You know, Mitchell Fenton in goal, and then a slew of middies that could contribute pretty easily. So I'm not worried about Colorado. Will they be as good as last year? You know, certainly not initially. You know, Jack Cranston was a phenomenal player. Tyler Doherty was a phenomenal player, but you know, I think they'll be able to reload and be just as competitive.
Tim Haslam, our MCLA insider, our guest here on Lacrosse Talk with Dan Matthews and Max Frater. Tim, I want to back up to Arizona State for a minute. You mentioned the faceoff X for Arizona State, where they do return Zach Andy, who was injured in that championship game last year. But Zach is a pinch and pop type of faceoff guy who's who typically picks the ball up in the back of his stick and moves it down the field and dishes. What do we do with Zach Handy with the new faceoff rules? Can he adjust, or will these rules truly impact his abilities?
That will certainly be a good question. You know, I saw him early last year at the Pac-12 shootout down at UCLA, and it was incredible. You know, I'd only seen one comparable kid in high school, and it's just incredible to watch him play, you know, and so it will be a question mark, you know. However, it's kind of like a kicker in football. They have one job, and that's, you know, for kicker, it's to kick field goals. And so when you get a kicker out there who misses a PAT, there's nothing much worse. And so, you know, this is probably all Zach's been working on is his new grips and his new styles. And, you know, that's probably all he's been doing. And I think he'll, you know, I think he'll be just fine. He was able to get to a high level before, so I think he'll be able to do it now.
When you're talking about Division I, you're looking at two major conferences. You're looking at the SLC with Arizona State and Grand Canyon and Arizona and all these guys, and then you're looking at the RMLC with Colorado State, things like that. Take a look at the SLC in Grand Canyon. They lost potentially the backbone of their team in Carson Barton last year to an ACL injury. He's coming back. And they bring in a DU transfer in Tyler Eckeroth. Is this the team that is going to be able to compete with ASU in that conference?
Yes, absolutely. You know, I when I was doing my top 20, which we'll probably get to later, but I've got Grand Canyon right at number 2, ahead of Arizona State, and so I think that they'll just be phenomenal. You know, they've got all the talent in the world. They've got good coaching, you know, and they're hungry. You know, they're largely unproven in the MCLA, and so they have a lot to prove, especially against a school like Arizona State and Arizona.
When we look, we mentioned the dominance of these two conferences, and we look at your top 20 just a little bit. We've got Colorado at 1, Grand Canyon at 2. Then we go back to the RMLC at BYU, 3, back to the SLC at Arizona State, 5. Or 4, and then at 5, you have Michigan State, that lone survivor coming out of the CCLA, who seems to be there each and every year. What's the key to success for Michigan State to crack into that top 4 and potentially be in the semifinals this year?
You know, they just got to be consistent. You know, I think that they've had their ups and downs. Like you said, they're always kind of in the mix, but never really are able to get over that hump. You know, they started out well last year, then they did a road trip to Colorado and, you know, lost to BYU. Then they lost to Colorado State, and everyone was like, oh no, you know, they're going to be 2-3, but hey, they beat Colorado, you know. Then they go on just a tear, and then they get to Davenport and lose to Davenport. Then they, you know, keep winning, and then guess what? They meet up with Colorado again in the playoffs, the championships, and just aren't able to get over that hump. So, It's kind of been a rocky slope, you know. They're kind of up, they're kind of down. So for that, it's just about being consistent and winning the games they're supposed to. And then, you know, obviously playing that tough competition, which is important for them because they need to get past the, you know, into the semifinals. Like you said, this year they'll be able to prove that. They're playing down at that Coaches for Cancer event in Phoenix. They got Chapman, BYU, and Grand Canyon. So we'll know early on if they're the real deal or not.
Dan mentioned at the beginning of this segment the newer teams to Division I that came out last year, and they came out firing, had a lot of success, teams like Westminster, Liberty, Davenport. A team I'm looking at that recently was an NCAA program, dropping down to the WCLL, is Dominican. There's already a lot of talent in there. You've got Stanford, Sonoma State, Cal Poly, things like that. But do you think Dominican, with their NCAA experience, will be able to immediately compete for that conference?
I do, absolutely. I think they'll be, you know, I think that they'll just fit right in that conference. You know, their head coach, Matt Blamey, I believe, is a Sonoma State guy. I think he used to coach there and maybe even went there. You know, so he's very familiar. Yeah, he was an assistant in 2012 and 2013 for the Seawolves there. So he knows what the MCLA is all about. You know, it won't be a shock to him. You know, and then at the end of the day, players will play anyone, right? And so it probably won't be a shock to the players either. And so I think they'll fit right in and certainly challenge for the conference.
When we look at other teams within the top 20, there's two teams that kind of stand out to me now in the SELC, in Virginia Tech and Liberty, and notably missing right now is Florida State, one of the perennial SELC powers, along with Georgia Tech sitting there too. What is specifically Liberty done that's made them so successful in their jump from D2 to D1? And put them on the map, and can they bust into the tournament at a higher seed than they did last year?
Your first point, you know, they've just done everything right. You know, we talked last week about building a team versus building a program, and they've built a program, and it's successful, and people want to play there. And so that's why, you know, Liberty's had success early on. You know, will they be able to get into the tournament? Probably. Will they be able to get a high seed? We'll have to see. You know, they've got Davenport on the schedule. They've got a road trip to Arizona, which will be a huge sign. You know,
if they can show well in those games, things will be favorable for them. I certainly don't expect them. You know, they'll certainly challenge Arizona, but I expect Grand Canyon and Arizona
they can beat them. Being pretty good, you know, but those will be telling signs. Then the rest of their schedules, you know, it's sort of average. You know, then they've got a good game against Michigan State in April, Florida State, and then they end at Virginia Tech, which could be a really fun game.
So, I mean, looking over the top 20 that, Tim, you put together and just kind of seeing the way that things played out last year, there's obviously a lot of talent in the field, and there's a little bit more parity growing in the MCLA. But at the end of the day, the championship always comes down to the RMLC. I mean, you've got BYU in 2011 after Michigan went on their run, three Colorado State, and then CU on the front end last year. Can we expect anybody else at the end of the day to be contending for a title that's outside of the RMLC other than Arizona State?
I could see Grand Canyon getting into that final game. You know, they will have. They've got little national tournament experience, though, you know, and that's the thing. BYU has national tournament experience. You know, they added a new coaching staff that has won the championship. Elliot Groh's on the staff now. He won it with the team in 2007. You look at Colorado State, obviously Alex Smith knows how to win championships. You look at Colorado, and obviously, you know, they know how to win championships. No one on Grand Canyon or for any other team for that matter has won the championship. And so it's going to be a challenge for whoever does. But at the end of the day, I certainly expect an RMLC team to be in the championship game. With, you know, if I was a betting man, I'd take them 80% of the time. That's for sure. You know, if you look at the Final Fours from the past 4 years, it's all SLC and RMLC teams. You know, the interesting thing about last year was three SL teams get in and they finally are like, all right, we're going to win one of these. Got a 75% chance, and they don't. And so you're right. It will come down to the RMLC, in my opinion. You know, and if that's the case, I think BYU is the best chance. But we'll definitely see. I think Grand Canyon could certainly give them a run for their money.
Tim, as we look at your preseason players of the year candidates, which one of these players needs to step up the most and put the team on his back for his team to generate greater success than might otherwise be expected?
That's a good question. You know, certainly Matt Alleming, the senior goalie at Michigan State, will have to play phenomenally for them to have a good season. You know, Dan Davis, like we talked about earlier at Arizona State, he'll have a lot to, there's a lot of shoes to fill on that squad. One kid that a lot of people probably don't know is Nick Sheehan out of California, Cal Berkeley. And, you know, I had a chance to watch him play down at the Pac-12 shootout. I think he's a phenomenal player, you know, and so if Cal were to make some noise, that he would certainly be the leader in that. And then you got Mike Fabrizio, you know, and 2 years ago he had just a stellar season, tons and tons of points. last year they brought on a freshman named Aaron Felstead, who shared the load with him, and you know, everyone was guarding Fabrizio, so Felstead has the chance to get in there and make some noise. The thing about Fabrizio is his little brother, Jack, is coming back from his mission this year, so there'll be two Fabrizios at attack. You know, so I don't necessarily think that he has to step up, but he's a senior. You know, he's the attackman. He's got a little brother on the team. His former high school head coach is now on the staff. And so he definitely has a lot to prove. A lot of, you know, a lot of people will be looking up to him. And then Sam Clair and Simon Frazier. You know, I feel Simon Frazier had a phenomenal season last year. And in order for them to keep that success, you know, that's kind of been Simon Frazier's knock, because they've had really good years and then really down years. So in order for them to be consistent, you know, I'd look to Sam Clair to be that guy. So who has the biggest load to carry? I don't know. I would say that they all do in their own way.
So, Tim, when you look at collegiate athletics, whether it be lacrosse, whether it be basketball, anything that has a major tournament, priority number one is obviously to win your conference. Priority number two is to get some key out-of-conference wins. Last year, we saw a team in Boston College go over to the West Coast, beat Chapman and BYU in consecutive games, and you could realistically say that bought them a ticket to the championship or to the tournament in 2014. Who do you see outside of the major conferences making some noise early on, picking up maybe one or two key out-of-conference wins that could set them up for a tournament bid in 2015?
Sure. You know, I think Boston College is in that boat again, certainly. You know, I would love to see a team out of the LSA some noise, whether that's Texas or Texas State, whoever. I don't really care who it is. I just want someone to do well out of that conference so we can start including them in some of these things. You know, and it's always fun to see what the WCLL can do. You know, can Cal Poly compete? Can, you know, is it Dominican this year? Can Sonoma, you know, get over there? You know, they're a team that's trending upward. Can they continue to do that? You know, then you look at the SCLC. There's, you know, any given year, it's anyone's team out there. And you know, they've put together some great squads in the past. And so it'll be interesting to see, you know, can Oregon get it together and get back? You know, we were talking about past national championships. You know, when was it? 2007. They were in the national championship. And we really haven't heard from them since. So, I don't know. There's just a ton of good teams, like you were saying earlier. You know, I'd really like to see Minnesota Duluth do well again, and get themselves back into the back into the national spotlight. So, kind of a long-winded answer, but there's a slew of teams that could potentially be that Boston College for this year.
I love it when a guest tees me up for a question that I was going to ask, whether you teed me up or not. But you mentioned the Oregon Ducks. It wasn't just 2 years ago that the Oregon Ducks played in the game of the tournament against Chapman in a second-round contest. All of a sudden, Ducks are nowhere to be found. What's led to this fast fall from grace for the University of Oregon lacrosse program?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, they've had just a couple up-and-down seasons, it feels like. You know, they got a new head coach last year, a guy who came over from Western Oregon, and Justin Eckenrode. And so, you know, it's always hard to get a new coach sometimes. Sometimes they fit right in. Sometimes it's hard to do that. And so maybe this is their year, you know. Then the other thing you look at is their schedule, you know. And look, let's call a spade a spade. The Northeast part of the country isn't so strong, and so they need to travel. You know, last year they went down to the Coaches for Cancer in Palm Springs, and, you know, they came away with two losses to BYU and Colorado State. Certainly two worthy opponents, you know. Then they went home after that and lost to Simon Fraser, a conference game. They got beat 15-5, you know. And so they just need to keep their heads up and keep playing those games and try to get over that hump. And, you know, then hopefully they'll be back in the spotlight.
Tim, look into your crystal ball for us and pick the Division I Final Four when it all pans out.
Oh, man, that's a good one. You know, I'd certainly, if I had to, I'd put BYU there. That'd be one of my teams. I would put Grand Canyon in that mix for sure. So there's two. If you look at who else, I'd love to see someone from the, you know, I'm in the RMLC as well as you are guys are, and I'd love to see some Perry though. So I'd love to see a Michigan State. But at the end of the day, I think it'll be two MCL or it'll be RMLC SLC. And so take your pick really at that point, you know, like I said, I definitely think the OAU pending any injuries and Grand Canyon pending any injuries will definitely be in that. And so, you know, pick them out of a hat for all I care at that point.
Yeah. Way to go out on a limb. We appreciate it. As always, Tim, and we'll look forward to talking MCLA with you each and every week here on Lacrosse Talk during the 2015 season.
Sounds good, guys. I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you, Tim.
Take care, Tim. That's Tim Haslam joining us on Lacrosse Talk to talk MCLA lacrosse with Max and I. I love it when things work out so great. Love technology. But, Tim, with some great insights as we head into the 2015 MCLA season, yeah, it sounds like, in general, we're going to be looking at the status quo with the MCLA. I'm hoping that we'll see a breakthrough team. We'll see a Michigan State, a Boston College that might be able to break through and be in there come championship weekend. I know that we're going to get a look at Boston College. They come out here to Colorado, and that will be one of the games against Colorado State on March 1st that we will attempt to bring you live coverage of on the newly formed Waxworm Radio Experience. Without any further ado, let's jump into our NCAA Division I preview and one Mr. Terry Foy from Inside Lacrosse. Good morning, Terry.
Hey, Dan. How's it going?
Doing well. How are you?
Excellent, thanks. Thanks for having me.
We're glad you could be here. Terry, we got this whole thing started last week, talking a little bit of Big East and America East and ACC lacrosse. Let's keep it rolling and jump into the newly formed Big Ten, which really I think has an interesting dynamic to it this year. In the one of the things that was mentioned in the Faceoff yearbook was that from top to bottom there may be a wide gap, but from any 1-2 or 2-3, there's not a real big gap in the quality of the program that we're going to be looking at in the Big Ten.
Yeah, and I think from a competitive aspect, that's a really important thing for a league that's trying to gain a foothold both within the Big Ten sports fan community and the lacrosse community as well. I think that, you know, there might be some lopsided games as we've seen, you know, when some of these teams have matched up in recent years, but I think that those gaps will probably close a little bit in 2015, and there will probably be, you know, a fair number of really exciting games as well. So I think that, you know, the story of the Big Ten's formation is one that will be told over the long haul. And the way that a conference with so many resources and such a – that is so tied into the fabric of the NCAA – having a vested interest in men's lacrosse specifically, but women's lacrosse certainly as well, can impact the culture and fabric of the game in a very unique way, is the long story here. But I think that the short version of that story is, you know, primarily Johns Hopkins competing for an automatic qualifier for the first time, but Johns Hopkins and Maryland being in the same conference and you know, Michigan, Ohio State, Penn State, three programs that are, you know, as tied to the identity of the Big Ten on their campus as they are, you know, to any other individual aspect of their identity, you know, those are the main storylines heading into this season.
Good morning, Terry, and thank you for joining us on the show this morning. You mentioned Johns Hopkins making the jump over to the Big Ten in order to compete for that automatic qualifier, but do you think they get it this year? I mean, because them jumping into the Big Ten, I think they take a big hit as far as their RPI goes, their strength of schedule, because they have to play everyone in the Big Ten. And if they end up not beating Maryland, they're going to have a harder time getting an at-large bid. So do you think Johns Hopkins gets that AQ in the first year as a Big Ten?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are some aspects of, you know, they lost a couple of games that they probably would have liked to have kept on the schedule. But, you know, don't forget that they, you know, they still play Syracuse, still play Virginia. This is not still play North Carolina, still play Princeton. This isn't a schedule that took a tremendous hit. It was, you know, the programs that got replaced by the additions of Rutgers and Penn State, who themselves are likely, in my opinion, not to be RPI slouches. You know, I expect to see Penn State no worse than high, you know, low 20s, meaning, you know, in that 2020, 21, 22 type range. But I expect them to be higher, and Rutgers, I would expect to finish the season in mid-30s at worst. You know, I think Hopkins' at-large resume, if they get the wins that they have gotten over the last couple of years, is going to be very equivalent to what it's been over the last couple of years. I mean, you know, I don't particularly like preseason. I prefer prognostications than predictions, and I think that, you know, that it's much easier for me to discuss something like, do I foresee Johns Hopkins being the number one overall seed heading into the Big Ten tournament? The idea of predicting the outcome of a, you know, 2 games in 3 days situation 3 months from now is pretty daunting. But I think that, you know, based on the conversations that I've had, and I wasn't able to get out to Hopkins and watch them practice this week, but based on the conversations that I've had with people who have, you know, I think that the early returns are buy on Johns Hopkins and sell on Maryland. And I think that when you look at the top of the Big Ten heading into this season, if that's true, then it only suggests that Hopkins is an even bigger favorite than they might have been in the fall when a lot of the face-off yearbook content was produced.
Terry, I look at a program like Michigan, who got its legs in the MCLA and was a championship team at the MCLA level for so long. This will be John Paul's fourth year now. How far away is Michigan from being, I don't want to say relevant, but being a player in the NCAA?
Well, I mean, you know, and I think that that's the beauty of a conference tournament, particularly a tournament in a 16 league. Basically, every team in a conference like that, their season is still in play, depending on how their schedule is structured, until the second last week of the regular season, meaning that you can, and we saw this most specifically with Detroit Mercy 2 years ago, you can really, really struggle in the early going when your final two games play your way into the third or fourth spot in your conference tournament, win two more games, and find yourself in the NCAA tournament. Now, obviously, for Michigan, given the quality competition they'll play in the Big Ten tournament, that's a pretty daunting task. But, you know, this is a team that made it to the ECAC tournament last year by virtue of essentially one win over Bellarmine. So the definition of relevance, the definition of being a player, is obviously very subjective, very open, and hard to quantify. My opinion is that what's so interesting about the way that Michigan has built their roster over the last couple of years is that it's been very bifurcated, meaning that, you know, coming into 2012 with a club roster was going to be a daunting task. And I think that we've seen the progression of that. In year over year, you saw a couple of freshmen come in and compete right away. And I think that what you're going to see in 2015 is a relatively few freshmen finding playing time. And this is the class that was essentially I would say that the freshmen in 2016 will be the first class that Michigan was actually like on foothold for as it relates to recruiting. They kind of started recruiting that high school 2015 class at the same time as everywhere else. This is the 2014 class is the last one where they were a little bit late. But my point is that they've gotten to a point where I think they expect the talent that will arrive over the next 3 years to be markedly better than the talent that is currently on campus. But the roster that they've currently constructed is one that they're pretty solidly ready to roll with over the next season or two. I think the biggest thing that will impact their chances of success in 2015 in contrast to 2014 is the level of play that they can expect in goal. And I think that Jerry Logan 2 years ago showed himself to be a bona fide top level elite quality goaltender. That's not to say that they didn't have quality on the roster last year, but their performance in that position wasn't up to the snuff that it was in 2013. If they get back to that level, combined with some of the offensive infusion that they've gotten, particularly last year with Ian King showing his capacity for being a goal-to-the-goal type player, you know, they really can. That's the recipe for winning a couple of games. And if they win the right couple of games, you know, say they beat Rutgers and then sneak one out against Penn State or Ohio State, they're in the inaugural Big Ten tournament. And to me, that means they're a player on the scene.
So Michigan on one side of things trying to put together a team to compete with the likes of Hopkins and Maryland. I want to take a look specifically at Maryland. You just mentioned when speaking to people who are familiar with Hopkins, you say buy Hopkins, sell Maryland. Maryland lost a ton of talent last year to graduation with Chan and Chuck, Rambo to suspension, Cannizzaro to transfer, and Nico Amato to graduation. Who should we expect to step up and take those spots from Maryland to stay on the course that they've been over the past couple of years?
Well, so before we get started, it's important to make clear that Matt Rambo, who I believe had his either second or third legal proceeding on the 15th on Thursday, it's still unclear what his status is going to be heading into the season. And I think that there's some reason to believe those around the program expect that, you know, it's possible he might not receive any on-field discipline as a result of the situation that develops in the fall. So, like I said, very much remains to be seen. And I would say that that's an important factor as it relates to, you know, how Maryland can theoretically expect to build their offense. The thing in losing Cannizzaro that's so troubling is that he was their creator. He was their initiator from X. And I think that it's difficult to imagine what they will be like in terms of those settled six-on-six possessions, you know, without him. Whereas, you know, if he were coming back, it would be a lot easier to imagine. And I think that, you know, it starts, I think, offensively with you know, Henry West and Joe LoCascio being the alley dodgers and shooters that they showed themselves to be at times last season. And I think that, you know, if you have Rambo sucking defenses towards that lefty wing, then you just create a little bit more space for your alley dodgers to dodge to shoot or dodge to pass. So I think that, you know, there are going to be opportunities for guys to emerge. You know, I expect Jay Carlson to have a big season because I think that Maryland's going to need him to have a big season. But beyond that, there is a tremendous amount of offensive talent, you know, guys that have been on campus for a couple of years and guys that were part of a highly touted class coming in last season, you know, that whether due to injury or whatever else didn't make, you know, as big a contributions as some might have expected in their freshman year. But, you know, Colin Heacock and Tim Rotan still have a tremendous amount to show. And I expect that, you know, from a talent perspective, Maryland is going to be able to show out offensively in 2015. It's just a matter of what is that going to look like and who specifically is going to be, you know, putting the ball in the net and making the plays to get the ball there.
Terry, Maryland and Hopkins, the most likely of the Big Ten teams to make it to the national tournament. Will a third team, can a third team make it? And if so, who would it be?
Not only could a third team make it, there is a scenario under which four teams could make it. I think, you know, specifically when you look at Penn State and Ohio State, there is a scenario under which, based on their schedule, it could unfold that all four teams make it. And you know, that's pretty easy to say because those four teams made it 2 years ago. So, you know, it's not as if it's an unheard of or unquestioned possibility. The fact that they're in the same conference doesn't really have the same limitation on the way in which they all impact each other's fates, so to speak. I think the biggest thing that could potentially happen in their favor is the ramp up of quality of schedule of their opponents, specifically Michigan and Rutgers, and how they treat them in contrast with some of the other types of similarly RPI positioned opponents that they would have played years past. My point is that Michigan and Rutgers could play tougher schedules than the 30s and 40s RPI teams that they filled out their schedule with 2 years ago, and that could be to their benefit of increasing the conference RPI overall, which would increase each team's individual RPI in turn, kind of the opposite of what we saw from the Patriot League squad last year. I think that Penn State is in an interesting position because, you know, not only did they graduate really well-known quantities like, you know, Shane Sturgis and the like, but they also graduated a tremendous volume of seniors from last year's team. So in every way, they're going to be a very new-look squad in 2015. But I think that coupled with, you know, the increased optimism of having a shot at the conference tournament, which is something that I think kind of weighed on them early in the season last year, not knowing that they didn't have a second bite at the apple, as it said, because the CAA decided not to include them in the 2014 postseason. I think that this, you know, there's a lot of factors, a lot of aspects of the way in which this team could be building itself quietly that remain to be seen. I saw them play in the fall and thought that they had a lot of work to do, but, you know, in the same way that we spoke about Duke last week, and I'm just very reluctant to buy into any type of negative aspect of you know, what could be going on at Duke, I feel pretty similarly about a Jeff Cambroni's coach team. So I think that there's a lot of reasons to think that they have an NCAA tournament team somewhere within them. And I think that you can make a relatively similar argument for Ohio State, albeit kind of an opposite one, that being that they have the personnel, they have the talent, that if every card falls in their way, they could find themselves in a similar type of situation. You know, I thought that in 2014 you saw both from injuries and from, you know, guys not necessarily playing up to a level that you might have expected, you saw some struggles last year. But, you know, in Jesse King, they've got a guy who on a lot of fields is going to be the best player. And if, I've long been a believer that if you are a team that can say that, it's not to the same level as it is in basketball, but you certainly are going to keep yourself in a lot of games and a lot of conversations that you otherwise wouldn't.
You're listening to Lacrosse Talk, the sport's first and most comprehensive show. Max Frater and Dan Matthews speaking with Inside Lacrosse's editor-in-chief, Terry Foy. Terry, I want to move over to the CAA now. Accurately titled The Thunderdome by College Cross, the online blog for SB Nation, which I had never heard before until I read it in the Faceoff yearbook. And I think it's epitomized by the CAA championship game last year between Drexel and Hofstra, a triple overtime slugfest. Drexel goes on to win it, has some success in the tournament before falling to Denver. How close is this race going to be for the conference championship this year as well?
As close as it always is. I mean, it's going to be one of those games that I wish that, you know, I wish there were a way that you could bet on anybody other than the number one seed winning the CAA championship, because it happens so infrequently based on, you know, two factors. The way that they did structure the tournament throughout most of the 2000s into this decade was unlike any other, where they, you know, the higher seed hosted every matchup. But then also, just based on how similar these programs are, you know, they're all relatively similarly funded. They're all, you know, have relatively similar identities. You know, they carry a similar size chip on their shoulder. I think it's interesting how much the coaches really like Hofstra. And I think that, you know, it speaks to a lot of the personnel that they are going to be able to rely on. And I think that, you know, it kind of starts with Sam Linares, who in my opinion is a very traditional ex-attackman in terms of his dual threat ability, you know, and kind of his pass-first mentality. So, you know, I think that that's hard to overlook. UMass is a program like Penn State and Duke in the way that they tend to do their best work in years when I think, you know, the expectations are relatively low. And I would say that in contrast with years past, the expectations in Amherst are relatively low based on the talent that they return. So it's another one that I'm going to be watching. You know, I think that Towson has some talent in places that is very sneaky. In a season when they won't have Thomas DiNapoli, it's easy to say, I wonder what Towson's going to do. And I will acknowledge that initiating the offense is going to be one of the biggest question marks heading into this year. But I like what they have over the course of much of the rest of the field. And then obviously the returning champion in Drexel, you know, it's a good team. It's a team that loses, you know, guys like Ben McIntosh and I believe Ryan Belka graduated as well. So, you know, they have a distributor in Cole Schaefer coming back that they can rely on. And, you know, there's no question that in Tyler Barbaridge, Corey Saputo, and a couple others, you know, the face-off competitions are going to be very interesting in the CAA as well. So my point is that making predictions about this league at any point, even including, you know, May 3rd or whatever the eve of the CAA championship ends up being, is faulty. Doing so on in the middle of January is even faultier. You know, it's definitely one of those situations where it's more worthwhile to sit back, relax, and enjoy the show.
Terry, 2015 marks the official complete and total dismantling of the ECAC. Fairfield joins the CAA this year. Is this a good long-term and short-term fit for the CAA and Fairfield?
It's interesting because Fairfield has been a team that, by my count, you know, between their presence in the MAC, the Great Western Lacrosse League, the ECAC, and now the CAA, you know, has been in four leagues in 10 years. So, you know, I would say largely, I don't know. I think that, you know, I spoke about the idea that these programs are, you know, similarly resourced, have a similar type of identity and a similar type of chip on their shoulder. And I would say that the first and third are true for Fairfield. But I would argue that, you know, in contrast with Delaware and Towson, you know, Fairfield does have a little bit of a different identity, you know, in terms of the types of players that they recruit, where they recruit from, you know. And so that's what one of the things that I'm going to be very interested in is, you know, how do they carve out a niche for themselves in this league? I think competitively it's a strong fit. I think from a, you know, you look around the league at the coaches, and I think that Andy Copeland fits in with his peers around the rest of the league in terms of his personality, his accomplishment, his resume. So I think that in a lot of ways, yes, there's reasons to be optimistic that this is, at the very least, a good short-term fit. You know, I've always been of the opinion that, you know, programs are at their best. They have their strongest sense of support, you know, when they are a part of the conference that is the athletic department in whole. And I think that it's been difficult for Fairfield to look around and find a comfortable home, kind of always hoping that the MAC was going to rise to the level of the program. And I thought that, you know, what you've seen over the last couple of years suggests that that may have been a possibility. But obviously, you know, with what they have invested in their lacrosse program in terms of facilities, coaches, and Gene Doris's obvious commitment to lacrosse with the ways in which he's served the sport as the athletic director at Fairfield, you know, it just wasn't a decision that they wanted to make. And they're obviously much more intimately involved in that than I am. So I can understand and trust their judgment. But, you know, I would be interested if in 6-7 years, Fairfield in the CAA remains the smartest fit for both the league and the program.
Terry, in a league that tends to beat each other up throughout the course of the season, the Blue Hens definitely took the biggest beating throughout the course of the year. They started off great, 5-2, then really struggled down the stretch, finishing 2-7, finally picking up a conference win against UMass. What were some of the gaps in this team that led to such a rough finish in the CAA, and where did they improve coming into this season?
Yeah, I mean, I got to plead ignorance on this one a little bit. Delaware is a program that I wasn't super familiar with last year. You know, depending on how their schedule shakes out, I've usually either gotten an opportunity to see them play, you know, half a dozen times or very little. And based on the way that our coverage patterns at Inside Lacrosse shake out, Matt Kinnear, my managing editor, is somebody, you know, he lives closer to Delaware. He's actually been up, you know, he goes up there a couple of times a year. So that's a question better served toward him. You know, I think that when you look at Delaware and the path to success that they've had, you know, over the course of the last decade, you know, it tends to be a relative star power oriented offense. And I think that for me, you know, that's no better explained than the Martin Cahill, Curtis Dixon era, you know, which was shortly after the Dan Deckelbaum, Jordan Hall era. And I think that, you know, when you looked at the roster in 2014, they just didn't have those couple of go-to guys to put the ball in the goal. And I think that it's hard to build a consistent winning team when that's the case. So I think that, you know, as you look to 2015, it's hard to make a prediction because Delaware is the type of program where stars emerge that you otherwise wouldn't have known who they were before they ended up playing really well at Delaware. You know, I think that their best known quantity is Tyler Barbaridge and at the faceoff X, and that's a really good place to start because you can control so much about the game if you can control possession. But beyond that, you know, I'm going to be able to watch the High Point game. So, you know, I think on February 2nd, I'll know a lot more about this squad than I do right now.
Terry, last but not least in the CAA, how far off is Towson from becoming a power within this conference?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting premise to the question. I would say that they're infinitely far off because I don't think that this is a league that can sustain a single power. It's a league in which every program is almost inherently cyclical, and in so every program has a shot at the title. I mean, Delaware was the you know, kind of consistent misser outer of that cycle because in so many instances they lost a heartbreaker in the conference championship game, and their RPI wasn't quite high enough to get them into the NCAA tournament. You know, I think that they were the first team or the second team out on the bubble at least three times in my tenure at Inside Lacrosse since 2008. So, you know, I think that Towson can win the CAA this year, but if Towson wins the CAA in 2015, I don't think it has a significant impact on whether or not they win the CAA in 2016 because winning the CAA basically just puts a target on your back, and that means that UMass and Delaware and Fairfield and Hofstra, you know, they're coming for you the following year. And I don't think that's it hasn't shown itself to be an enviable place to be.
Shifting gears, Terry, into the last conference we'll preview today, into the Ivy League. This conference, historically, and it looks like it's going to prove out to be the same this year, top to bottom, or at least 1 through 6, may be the most competitive conference of all of them. Accurate to say?
Yeah, I mean, on a year-to-year basis, I would say no, because of how, you know, consistent Cornell has been at the top of the league. You know, Yale being a program that has emerged over the last 5 years in a way that hadn't been true in the previous decade definitely kind of crafted a competitive balance in a unique way. So it's becoming a team in which, or a league in which, you know, number 5 or number 6 in the preseason prognostications can knock off number 1 or number 2. And there's a lot of value in that. But I would say that, you know, top to bottom, the league that we just talked about, CAA, remains the most competitive on a year-over-year basis. I would think that the thing that, you know, the Ivy League brings to the table in 2015 that is unique is while Cornell, looking like what they looked like last year and returning Matt Donovan, Connor Busick, Jordan Stevens, and a really solid goalie situation, if it ends up being Christian Knight or not, is probably the team that is best positioned and has the best argument for being the preseason number 1, and I understand that. But at the same time, you know, there are a couple of flaws that will be interesting to see how they address, a couple of questions, you know, year over year from 2014. And as a result, as you look down the rest of the preseason coaches poll, you know, you can imagine 5 teams finishing in first place. And I think that, you know, that's a relative rarity. That's something that isn't true in a lot of leagues. You know, the ACC might be the only other league for which I would say that is as true. And, you know, kind of as a result of that, I think that that's where the comment of competition comes into play, Dan. It might not necessarily be that all the teams are going to finish 3-3 or 4-2 in conference. You know, I think that it's, you can imagine any one of these teams figuring out a way to go 5-1 and hosting the conference tournament.
So, Terry, last week when we were talking about the ACC, I had mentioned North Carolina as one of those teams that consistently brings in top talent but can't find a way to put it all together on the field. In the Ivy League, I see a similar team like that in Princeton, who year after year brings in these rock star recruits and these professional league guys. I mean, not seeing Tom Schreiber in the NCAA tournament last year, I felt like was a travesty. So do you feel like this year, and I won't make you predict who the conference champ is going to be, but do you think Princeton has the pieces to at least earn a number 1 seed heading into the tournament?
Yeah, it's interesting because there's, you know, there, I would say that of the 5 teams that I believe, you know, could win the Ivy League, Princeton would be the least likely, in my opinion, right now. I think that there is a little bit of Bill Simmons-Ewing theory potential with Schreiber, not because of anything that was deficient in his game, but because of the way in which, at times last year, you saw his teammates waiting for him to do something. And I think that there's a possibility that even though they have tremendous talent on this, you know, this midfield in particular, you know, starting with Kip Orban and Jeff Acaro, there is a chance that they as a unit might be a little bit more productive. But, you know, the thing that I saw in Princeton in 2014 is that it wasn't as if there was an overall glaring deficiency. It was that they just weren't quite good enough in most areas. So I like a team that requires only incremental improvement pretty much all the way across the board a lot more than a team that needs to make a drastic improvement in one specific place. So in that way, I can see a path to success for them existing. I just don't know if it's as likely as it is, you know, say for Penn or Harvard or even Brown. But the comment, you know, the question, the way that you posed it, I thought you were going to lead me down a path toward Harvard, because I think that that's a pretty common perception about the Crimson as well. And I think it's one of the things that, you know, Harvard fans should be so encouraged by as it relates to their making it to the NCAA tournament last year. You know, they are a program that, you know, for the previous 5 years had a number of very highly talented recruits that didn't necessarily translate into wins on the field. And I think that in 2014, you saw them emerge offensively and defensively in a way that was, you know, schematically and systematically a little bit closer to what Coach Wojcik, I think, wants to see. You know, it was on the defensive end of the field, it was something like Brian Fisher being able to hold Schreiber scoreless. And at the offensive end of the field, it was something like Devin Dwyer being that ball-moving maestro that you know, everybody saw at Garden City. So I think that it's kind of an interesting comparison to say that, you know, Princeton's the program that brings in the talent, where I don't disagree with that, but I also think that, you know, Harvard is the one that is more positioned to be like Carolina heading into 2015, where we saw a little bit in the way of the coming to fruition of that, that talent on campus, but not being able to translate into the wins. You know, I think that, you know, Carolina in 2013 struck me as a team that had a different character about them, and I thought maybe that was going to translate into 2014. And I think that that was what we saw from Harvard last year, is they had a little bit of that different character about them. And because of what they return, it's a very fair question to wonder if they're going to be able to translate that into even more success in 2015.
Terry, recruiting as a whole within the Ivy League is a difficult process. But the one team that really seems to struggle consistently and has not had a real quality product on the field for quite some time now is Dartmouth. What challenges in particular does Dartmouth face when it comes to building a program that can consistently compete within the Ivy League?
Well, I mean, there are a number of challenges. And I think that, you know, not to get into a treatise about what Dartmouth has to overcome in order to be successful in the Brennan Callahan era that they have been only a couple of times throughout the recent history of the program. But, you know, it's a place where, you know, the student culture life is really important. It's a place where practicing outside is pretty difficult. And, you know, I think that those two things are things that make it difficult to get the types of lacrosse players on campus that you need, that you've shown that you need to be successful in the Ivy League. But I'm very interested to see what Brennan Callahan can do, because, you know, I have an interesting perspective on him, being the same age as him, knowing who he was coming out of high school, following his career at Stony Brook, following his coaching career. You know, he's definitely developed a really solid reputation in the coaching community for the work ethic that he has put in on the recruiting trail, as well as for some of the innovations that he has made, you know, particularly in terms of developing some defensive schemes at Lehigh. You know, I think that Kevin Cassis is a coach who has shown himself to be very willing to give up control to his coordinators, and I think that that will be to Brennan's benefit as he takes over his own program. And I think that, you know, it's going to be a long project for Dartmouth, because the way that this coaching search worked out, the way that Andy Towers' departure from the program worked out on a timeline perspective last summer was very problematic, and the type of thing that could carry a rebuilding project a year later into the future. But the question, you know, the fact remains that an Ivy League education is something that is one of the most appealing brass rings for any high school athlete in this sport. And it's something that, you know, Brennan only has to compete with against six other programs. So, you know, I think that the path to success is pretty clear. It's about, you know, finding the types of players who value that educational opportunity, but at the same time want to take college lacrosse very seriously, making sure that they remain on that path throughout their 4 years, you know, building through development, making sure that they get better, and then, you know, figuring out ways to win games. It sounds simple, because it kind of is a simple process. It's a simple idea. It's a very much more difficult challenge to fill.
Terry, as always, we appreciate your time on Lacrosse Talk. I will look forward to seeing you in your home state of Baltimore or Maryland on Thursday, and Max will chat with you next week as we wrap up our NCAA Division I preview.
Thanks as always, guys.
Thanks, Terry.
That's Terry Foy, editor-in-chief of Inside Lacrosse Magazine, joining us to talk NCAA Division I men's lacrosse. We're going to shift gears now to the women's side of the game, and IL Women's editor Hallie Quillinan joining us today. Hi, Hallie. How are you?
Hi. Good. Good. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. We appreciate your time on a Sunday morning. Hope you weren't out partying too late last night.
No, we weren't out partying at all. Actually, a colleague of ours, Steven Berger, was inducted to the Baltimore chapter, US Lacrosse Hall of Fame. So we were all at that induction ceremony last night here in Baltimore.
And congratulations to Stephen, by the way. I meant to mention that at the top of the show. Hallie, let's dive into this Women's Division I Top 20. And it looks vaguely familiar over the last 3 or 4 years. But the one thing that I'm noticing kind of each and every year right now is a slide by Northwestern. What's happening in the Chicagoland area with that Northwestern program that they continue to slide in these preseason rankings?
I think that this year is just a very interesting, and some view it as an exciting year in Evanston. Last year, they graduated a very talented senior class that I think for so many people flew under the radar. Alyssa Leonard got a lot of the praise. She's the NCAA career leader in draw control. She was their leading scorer. But they also lost Carrie Harrington. They lost Kat Duranda. They lost a really talented team that did a lot of the work all over the field. But they also brought in the number one incoming freshman class. So I don't think that we'll actually see them slide. I know in our preseason fold, they're ranked eighth, a place where a lot of teams wish they were heading into the season. But I think that Northwestern will climb. They lost a lot of personnel, and it's going to be really fun to see how this heralded group of freshmen, Selena Lasota and Shelby Frederick were our 3 and 4 incoming recruits, respectively. It's going to be nice to see them kind of get in, get their feet wet, and make names for themselves for Northwestern. So I don't think Northwestern is dropping. I hate to use the word. I think it's that they've been rebuilding in the off season, but we've seen with Kelly Monty Hiller, they really don't rebuild. They more or less reload. So I think that they're going to be right in the hunt again in 2015.
Hallie, thank you for joining me and Dan on the show this morning. With the formation of the Big Ten coming into effect this year, and we talked just now with Terry Foy a lot about it, it brings up the discussion of which becomes the most talented conference or which is the strongest top to bottom. We talked about that a lot in the men's side of things, and I think the argument comes up on the women's side as well. So in your mind, looking at the teams from top to bottom, which is the strongest conference between the ACC and the Big Ten?
I think that that's probably such a loaded question, first and foremost. I mean, you have the two most prolific women's lacrosse and arguably just lacrosse programs over the course of the last 2 decades. In the Big Ten, between Maryland and Northwestern, the Big Ten Conference features teams that have won a combined 23 national championships, 19 of the 32 NCAA championships, 8 of the last 9. I think that Maryland and Northwestern, that conference rivalry will become one of the most respected, but fierce rivalries that our sport's ever seen. And then you throw in teams like Penn State and Ohio State, two teams that have been knocking on the top 5, top 10 the last few years. I think both of those teams have probably the strongest roster that they've had in the last 2 years coming into 2015, so that's very exciting. But you look at the ACC, and it's kind of strength by numbers. They bring in North Carolina. They bring in Syracuse, Virginia, Duke, Boston College, Notre Dame. Those are teams, they take up half of our preseason top 10. I think are two of the nation's strongest teams in the Big Ten, yes. I think just numbers-wise, there's more strength, at least heading into the season, in the ACC.
Hallie, the one team that does not get a lot of talk as we enter the season year in and year out is Joe Spallina's Stony Brook women's squad. Joe has quietly built a very solid program at Stony Brook, much as he has with the Lizards of Major League Lacrosse. What is the root of Joe's success in being able to transition between the men's and women's game and be consistently successful?
I think you just touched on it. I think he brings a lot of his experience in the men's game into the women's game, and I think vice versa to a certain extent. He's a great coach. I think one thing that you can say about Joe Spallina is he gets the most out of his players. Last year, they graduated such tremendous talent. Their freshmen stole the show in 2014. Michelle Rubino, in my opinion, a senior midfielder, she's one of the best end-to-end players in the nation. And she was the third leading scorer on this team a season ago. So I think one thing about Joe is he gets the most out of his players. And he also brings a little bit of experimentation into the women's game. You know, they throw so many different defensive and offensive sets at a team that it's really hard to prepare. I think as a coach, when other teams are preparing to play your team and they're not quite sure what you're going to throw at them, you've done an incredible job. And I think he takes a lot of that innovation from the men's game, you know, whether it's a box lacrosse background or kind of the men's lacrosse flavor that he's brought to Stony Brook. You know, they're an exciting team to play, to watch play. Their offense is explosive. Last year they had our Isle Women Goalkeeper of the Year, Frankie Caridi. So I think replacing her is probably the biggest question mark for Stony Brook this year. But, you know, we had them ranked 15 in our preseason poll, and I think that's probably the lowest they'll be. I think they have a lot of opportunity this year on their schedule. They're playing USC to kick off the season. They're going to be playing Northwestern. I think they're scheduling more and more competition that will allow them to grow and move up in the ranks.
So, Hallie, with NCAA lacrosse, I mean, there's new programs popping up all over the country, but it seems like with women's lacrosse, the majority of them are coming up on the West Coast or the Western part of the United States, which definitely opens things up for recruiting. I mean, being able to be in the sun year-round and be able to play year-round is definitely enticing for a lot of girls who are looking to play collegiate lacrosse. Which one of these Western schools in the MPSF do you see kind of breaking through this year and possibly making it to the big dance?
You know, I think USC is number one in my mind. I say that for a couple different reasons. USC is just such a storied athletic program. I think that they support their athletes very well. You know, I think that their coaching staff really is a cut above the rest. Lindsay Monday, I can't say enough good things about her as a player. She's obviously one of the best of all time. I think she learned an immense amount not only playing, but coaching under Kelly Amante Hiller. And then look at the rest of her staff. Devin Wills, one of the top defensive minds our game has seen, the U.S. team goalkeeper now. And then Alyssa Leonard. I think a big key for this USC team is their success on the draw control. And it will be very interesting to see the immediate impact that Alyssa Leonard has on this USC lineup. Last year we saw the tip of the iceberg. They beat perennial power Stanford in the regular season. For a young team that brought in two of the nation's top recruits in Gussie Johns and Lydia Sutton, I think USC is definitely a team on the rise that people should circle that game on their schedule. And I also think Colorado. You know, Paige Stokinson is one of the top goalkeepers in the country. She had an outstanding freshman season. A good goalie makes a good team great, and I think that that's what Colorado has in Paige. You know, they return a lot of their scorers. They return Jonna Fusco, their leading scorer. She's a very talented midfielder that I think went under the radar in the recruiting process. We saw how strong she was for Colorado last year, and you know, they were a young team. They return a lot of experience. I think Colorado and USC will definitely be two teams on the rise this year.
Hallie, when we look at the MPSF, Denver finally broke through last year, making it to the national tournament. Stanford is sitting there in number 20 in your top 20 poll. So you got Denver and Stanford. You talk about USC and Colorado. How far off is the MPSF from becoming one of the preeminent women's lacrosse conferences, maybe not completely along the likes of the ACC and the Big Ten, but being right in the thick of things?
I don't think they're far off at all. I think especially if you look at the youth that some of these programs have, you know, they haven't been around for that long. You know, I think Liza Kelly has done a great job with the Pioneers. They return probably the strongest team we've seen them have in quite some time. You know, when you return a player like Jill Remenap and you return a goalkeeper like Hannah Hook, you know, you have your last line of defense and you have your quarterback. And I think that's huge for Denver heading into the season. And then Stanford has, you know, I think that they are just so well coached. I think Amy Bacher does a great job preparing her team for whatever matchup lies ahead. And once again, they're a team that returns a lot of people that made huge impact last year. I think Hannah Farr is one of the top players in the game. She's a multi-sport athlete. She also plays soccer, and she just attacks every ball hard. I think that more and more, as you mentioned, I think recruits are taking a chance. They're going west more often. And I think a lot of these girls are building something very special for these programs. And I think, as you mentioned, you know, they might not be the ACC or the Big Ten next year or in the next 5 years. But as you see, you're going to see more than two teams in the top 20 heading into season. I think USC, Colorado, those are probably the two teams that should continue to rise in the ranks. But I think Denver and Stanford could continue to rise, and I think they both will in 2015.
So, Hallie, you gave us the breakdown of which teams we should expect to be primed to have a good season this year. Talk about some of the individuals. And you put together a kind of Player of the Year watch in the Face-Off yearbook for Inside Lacrosse. Just go over a couple of those players who we should know, those names that we should know going into this season that could be possible Tweraton Award finalists.
I think taking probably the remaining Tweraton finalists out of this discussion. Taylor Cummings, obviously a go-to player for Maryland. Kayla Trainer, probably the best attacker I've ever seen play the game. And then obviously include Shannon Gilroy and Megan Dowdy. Beyond those four that all are Tweraton finalists returning to their team, I think a huge player to watch this year is going to be Barbara Sullivan for Notre Dame. She was a first-team All-American defender in 2013. Last year, she played limited. She saw limited action in Notre Dame's first few games of the season before ultimately missing the remainder of the season due to injury. She is just a ball player. She is around the action for the full 60 minutes. She attacks ground balls. She causes turnovers. She gets key draw controls. She's there one man clear at times. I think for Notre Dame, losing Margaret Smith was a huge loss because she did so much of the work there. But bringing back Barbara Sullivan, she's one of the best defensive players we've seen in the last few years. So she's a huge breakout player to watch. And then another player, I think she's been on everyone's radar for a long time, but I'm certainly ready to see her make that jump into the Tweraton discussion, is Michaela Ricks. Just kind of similar to Sullivan. They both played in high school together at Garden City. I'm not sure if there's a certain way that they kind of bring them up through the program there, but Michaela Ricks does it all. She scores goals. She grabs ground balls. She brings home draw controls. She causes turnovers. She doesn't tire. She's really a fun player to watch because end-to-end, she makes impact all over the field. And I think that this is really Boston College's year to make it to the Final Four. They brought in Kavi Stanwyck and Michaela Ricks, and that was huge for the program and helping them grow. And this year is their final year, and I think we're going to see that team make a statement, and I think Michaela Ricks should be in the Tweraton discussion.
Hallie, we sure appreciate the early season preview, and we'll look forward to talking to you with a lot of regularity on Lacrosse Talk during the coming months.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Thank you, Hallie.
That's Hallie Quillinen joining us here on Lacrosse Talk to talk women's lacrosse in the NCAA. And a segment of the game that unfortunately so far doesn't get quite the coverage that it probably deserves on a consistent basis. And it would be my hope that we will continue this relationship with Hallie and IL and bring to the forefront the women's game.
And props to her and the rest of the IL staff that put together the preseason conference rankings and All-Americans and conference outlooks for everything women's NCAA D1. I mean, pretty much everything that we need to know here going into the season is right here in front of us in this yearbook. So well done by everybody who contributed to that. I still have plenty of homework to do on the women's side of things, but I'm glad that we're bringing it on as a part of Lacrosse Talk.
Yeah, absolutely, without a doubt. We're going to keep things rolling. We're going to jump into box lacrosse in the National Lacrosse League with Brian Shanahan. Shanny, a quiet weekend in the National Lacrosse League.
Yeah, it sure was. But before I get started, I want to say I'm glad you got the women's on too. My daughter's going to play D1 at Canisius next year. She'll be a freshman, and so maybe I'll be your women's expert next year too, but I really doubt that part. But, yeah, a very quiet weekend. Just one game on the slate. It was the Buffalo Bandits in Vancouver. And it was a close game. It was a 14-13 game. But despite the score, I wouldn't call it a barn burner. Buffalo built up an early 4-1 lead, and they never gave that up the rest of the game. I think at one point Vancouver tied it up briefly, but it seemed to be the type of game that Buffalo would go up by three. Vancouver would get within one. And the Buffalo would go up, and it just kept going back and forth. But never in that game did Vancouver lead, other than I think the first goal of the game. And in fact, Buffalo had the lead for over 50 minutes of the 60-minute game. So while looking at a close game, it looks like it was really exciting. I never really felt like it was as exciting as the score might indicate. Buffalo controlled it the way I saw it, and Vancouver missing a few guys on the defensive end, missing Chris O'Doherty and Rory Smith and Tyler Garrison, and I found that was really the difference. When Vancouver looked like they were making their comebacks, they were never able to stop Buffalo, and too often did Buffalo scored in bunches. So despite the close score, I thought that was a solid victory for the Buffalo Bandits.
Shanny, the National Lacrosse League has a couple of weekends like this during the course of the 2015 season. What's the logic behind only having one game in a weekend when you're trying to put a consistent quality product out on the field?
I really don't understand. I doubt it's a plan. I'm just guessing that it's a quirk that, you know, with scheduling, you know, the National Lacrosse League doesn't have first dibs in the arena dates. You've got most of the rinks that they play, and you've got NHL hockey, and you've got NBA. So I'm guessing that it's just a quirk that's happened on some weekends that, it's been tough to get arena days. But, no, I really don't know. I don't think they've, decided to do that. Because, I don't like it. It makes it a lot easier for me to do my power rankings. I almost feel like I have the weekend off. But I much prefer the busy weekends.
And, Shanny, I feel like everybody else in the league other than Buffalo-Vancouver had the same idea as you. It was almost like a week off. I mean, as a coach, what do you tell your players on a week like this? Like, hey, guys, just make sure you keep sticking your hands and are going over our plays. I mean, you don't have a chance to practice for an entire week, especially in a league like the NLL. That's got to hurt more than help.
Well, for sure. And, I don't know. It'd be interesting to find out how many teams actually do practice on an off weekend, because not everybody can do it, and it could get expensive if you're the type of team that's flying in a lot of players. Are you going to fly everybody in for a weekend practice? I doubt that. But, where some teams would have an advantage, the Toronto Rock could easily run a practice this weekend. You know, all their players live in Ontario, or, all their players live within an hour of the practice rink. So you would think the teams that can do that, I'm sure Rochester's in the same situation, and a few other teams, but you'd have to think they have a bit of an advantage that they can get all their guys together for the off week to have a good practice. And in some of those cases, if there's injuries, it gives more time for guys to heal. But, yeah, not every team has that luxury. I really doubt that Colorado is flying in all their players for a weekend practice, but, I couldn't say for sure.
Shanny, I'm assuming that there will be little, if any, change in your power rankings after just one game this weekend. Is it a fairly safe assessment?
Yeah, I think there was just a slight change. I think Buffalo just moved up a notch in the power rankings. But other than that, there's no changes. The Toronto Rock is still number one. And I think I had Colorado number two. And then down at the bottom is still the shocking Edmonton. I've got Rochester I've got at the very bottom, and just above them is Edmonton and Calgary, which, I mentioned last week in my power rankings, it looks like the NLL world is upside down. I can't see it staying like that. But having said that, next weekend, Edmonton and Calgary meet each other for the first game in the Battle of Alberta this year. So one of those teams is going to be 0-3. And who would have ever imagined that, then after three games, one of the Alberta teams could be winless.
Sure.
So, Brian, I mean, I guess all we can do at this point now is just kind of look forward to next week. We have a full slate of games on the schedule. You mentioned the first battle for Alberta between Edmonton and Calgary. What are some of the other games that are going to be a little bit more high profile for us to tune into?
Well, I think it's going to be a pretty exciting weekend for the Toronto Rock. They host the Buffalo Bandits for Toronto's home opener Friday night. Then they have to get on a bus and drive to Rochester for a game. Rochester already playing their second game in Rochester, which is another quirk, you know, two games in Rochester before they host them. But, you know, so Toronto started the season, you know, off 2-0. They could very likely be 2-2 after this weekend, but I think you know, they would love to at least split those two games, and if they were to win those two, then we're starting talking about what a great season the Rock is having. I know the Rock's off to a great start, but two games doesn't make a season. We'll see what happens. It should be a very telling weekend for them coming up.
Shanny, we'll catch up with you next week when there will be a whole heck of a lot more to talk about in the National Lacrosse League.
Okay, excellent, boys. Good talking to you, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Brian Shanahan joining us here on Lacrosse Talk to talk all things National Lacrosse League. Just like last week where we bookended the show with the MCLA, we're going to bookend this week's show with the MCLA as well and bring in one of my favorite MCLA personalities, Manny Rapkin, head coach at Grand Canyon University. Hi, Manny.
Hey, Dan.
Manny, at least one of the preseason prognostications has you guys sitting at number two. The other that I've seen has you sitting at number seven. What is the core strength of your Grand Canyon program this year?
I would say eight returning seniors, our first senior class. It's my first recruiting class at Grand Canyon. I'd say that's our core strength. And then they have a good goalkeeper and some guys that can put the ball in the goal. But I would, again, I'd say our eight seniors.
Coach Rapkin, thank you for joining me and Dan on the show this morning. Talk about what it's like to have Carson Barton back on your roster after last year losing him to an ACL tear. I mean, we've heard from everybody else around the league saying how much it's going to improve your team, but what are you seeing from him coming back from that injury right now?
Well, just him being around our program and being involved in practice. Last year, spring semester, Carson was on the sideline, and he was with us every day in practice. But he's more of a quiet leader. He's a guy that leads by example on the field. You watch the way he plays, the way he grinds it out every day in practice. I think that's what the guys see, and that's what they're seeing now. A little bit different when Carson's on the sideline. Having him back on the field is huge for us this year.
Manny, you've got a transfer coming in Tyler Ekeroff from the University of Denver. What kind of presence will Tyler bring coming from a major D1 program to playing at Grand Canyon?
Well, you know, it's the first day. He impressed all of us. He's a talented player. And, you know, just another piece in our puzzle. He brings, works hard every day in practice, and he's an intense player when he gets on the field. Having that kind of talent around, I think definitely people recognize it, guys in practice see it, and it's definitely going to help us this year.
Coach, obviously you guys have the talent and are competing in a tough enough league where you'd be able to make some noise. If not winning the conference, then earning an at-large bid. But a lot of the pundits are saying that GCU does not have that tournament experience to push forward. What is your response to that?
I mean, we just have to get it done on the field. Last year was a disappointment. I think we had enough talent to to do some damage in the postseason, but we never got there. I think the focus now is just, you know, winning games. That's it. And working hard in practice and becoming a better team. You know, you can make all kinds of assumptions based on talent, and you can look at the roster and try to, you know, sum up what the season's going to look like, but really won't know much until we play, you know, start playing games. But I think the team, our team has the talent to be a postseason team, but again, that remains to be seen.
You're listening to Lacrosse Talk, North America's first and most comprehensive show dedicated to the sport. Dan Matthews and Max Frater with Grand Canyon University head coach Manny Rapkin. Manny, you guys played your fall ball games and had a round robin of sorts with the University of Arizona and Arizona State. What did you learn during fall ball, both about your squad and the other two major programs in the state of Arizona?
Lacrosse at the collegiate level is getting better in Arizona. All three teams are talented. You know, they're unique universities, but together they a group of universities that are attracting really good lacrosse players. One thing I think they have in common is that, you know, the state, the weather. I mean, lacrosse players want to come here and play lacrosse, and get on the field in January, and almost never miss a day to inclement weather. And it's just a great place to play lacrosse. So but for that and a lot of other reasons, you know, the three schools here in Arizona are attracting lots of talent. And you could see that in November. U of A's got a huge squad, a lot of talented players, and a second-year coach with a lot of coaching experience, and U of A as well. You know, good coaching, lots of good players.
Coach, we already mentioned Carson Barton and Tyler Eckeroth. Who are some of the other big names on this roster, leaders on your team who we should be looking out for in this coming season?
Tate Linford, senior captain. A four-year starter on defense for us. You know, he's been, you know, one of the important parts of building this program, and he's, you know, probably as far as experience and talent, he's probably our best defenseman. Brandon Sushan, our sophomore goalie, as a lot of the blogs have been talking about, there are very few top 20 teams that are returning their starting goalie. We're fortunate enough to have him back. At the midfield, you know, we have, for the first time in a while, we have depth at the midfield. And so, you know, I wouldn't say any one particular person. We just have lots of talented players in a lot of positions. We return four All-Americans, Ron Hamway, our faceoff specialist, Dean Farrell, attackman, with 60-plus points last year. Sushand was a third-team All-American, and Louis Dean Adonis, our long-stick middy. So I think, you know, those guys are going to continue doing the things that they were doing. We have a good freshman class. I think there's some freshmen that are going to help us out. We have one freshman that I think is going to crack one of the first two midfield lines. Cody Clark is a freshman from Nanaimo, British Columbia. So lots of pieces, lots of, as I said, talented players. Just got to put it all together and so our season doesn't end like it did last year.
Manny, we appreciate you coming on to talk GCU lacrosse with us, and I will look forward to seeing you in mid-March when we do some live play-by-play of your games against Liberty in Texas.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Dan.
Thanks, Manny.
Thanks, Coach. Good luck.
Thank you.
That's Manny Rapkin joining us here on Lacrosse Talk, a great show bookended by the MCLA. Thanks to Tim Haslam and Manny Rapkin for joining us, as well as Terry Foy, Hallie Quillinen, and Brian Shanahan. For Max Frater,
I'm Dan Matthews saying so long, everyone.